Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. This is Peter Krishnagner, your host. Today, we're speaking with Daniel Prosterman about his book, Defining Democracy, Electoral Reform and the Struggle for Power in New York City. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming on. Why don't you start us off telling us about yourself and how you got to the project?
Sure. I'm Dan Prosterman. I'm an assistant professor of history at Salem College, a women's college in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. This project started way back in my doctoral studies at New York University. And to be honest, if I can date myself a little bit, I became interested in this work around the time of the 2000 presidential election, when there were a lot of questions about possible third-party runs by folks like Ralph Nader, Pat Buchanan, and the like. While no one really ever gave third parties much of a chance in the 2000 election, as you might remember, there were some questions about what kind of influence folks like Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader might have had over the ultimate outcome of that election. So I was interested in the question of the influence of third-party politicians in our traditional two-party system. And that brought me to this sort of moment in time in New York City political history, when for about 10 years, we have a system known in New York City as proportional representation, known elsewhere throughout the world as the single transferable vote, or STV, where in New York City council elections, New Yorkers were essentially able to rank candidates on their ballot. They were able to basically give their own preferences for where their vote went in terms of their city council choices. And if their first choice wasn't elected, they were able to offer a second choice or a third choice or a fourth choice. And for this 10-year period, what we see is that New Yorkers were quite interested and engaged with the electoral process for the city council, which is something that historically New Yorkers really hadn't been that engaged in, at least not to the extent that they were during this 10-year period. What happened when they were given the opportunity to use the proportional representation system is that we see an explosion in the diversity of people who are elected to the city council. Whereas before, you really had exclusively Democrats and Republicans, for the most part, that are elected to the council, with Democrats holding almost complete control over what was before the Board of Aldermen. After PR is instituted in the 1930s, you then have the American Labor Party, you have independent Democrats, independent Republicans, people who aren't affiliated with the bosses of Tammany Hall, the traditional leaders of the Republican Party. They're able to gain elective office in New York City for the first time. Pretty soon thereafter, you have Communist Party members who were gaining elective office in New York City for the first time ever. Perhaps more importantly, you also have women who are able to win office in New York City in greater numbers than had ever happened before. The first African Americans are able to win council seats for the first time ever. And this all happens because New Yorkers are able to participate in the electoral process in a fundamentally different way that runs contrary to the traditional two-party system. And I found this 10-year period from the mid-1930s to roughly the mid-1940s as a fascinating glimpse into a sort of alternate history of a democracy in the United States, sort of what would happen if we didn't have a sort of two-party system that runs lockstep with Democrats running against Republicans in most of our elections. And in New York during this period, we have a dramatically different vision of democracy.
Right. I mean, America's where third parties go to die historically. Right. But You make the note at some point. There are structural reasons for that, right? And the two parties conspire to keep that system going. And so this really is a sort of remarkable period, and it's a very notable period in New York City history for a number of reasons. But this is sort of behind some of that, it seems. And it's not unique. There's other experiments like this going around the country. So it's a very interesting period to say the least. But you note that the logistics of PR as practiced in New York were messy, to say the least, right?
That's absolutely right. And reformers had been trying to bring PR to New York City for a long time. This wasn't just something that was drawn up in 1933 and then proposed in 1936 and then brought in whole cloth. Instead, New Yorkers had developed this system way back in the 19th century. It was brought across the Atlantic and had been experimented with in a variety of other places throughout the world. Its origins were in Europe. And when it was finally transplanted to the United States, it had been integrated in a variety of smaller cities in the United States, places in Ohio, in Colorado, and in other smaller cities in Connecticut and the like, where voters in those smaller towns had begun to try again what was known as the single transferable vote option, where voters get to rank candidates. In New York City, reformers appreciated the opportunities that they saw this model offering them, but when they looked at it in the 19th century, they saw it as a way of limiting the suffrage, as a way of curtailing diversity in representation. Because in the 19th century, the reform movement in New York City was primarily interested in weakening immigrant voting power, in weakening what they saw as the base of support for Tammany Hall, Boss Tweed, and the like. And the initial proposals for the so-called good government movement and proportional representation in the mid to late 19th century were about using PR to increase elite rule rather than increase popular rule. For that reason, it was kind of a nativist proposal, and it didn't go anywhere at that time. But that changes fundamentally in the early 20th century. And then we have a sort of transition in the reform movement, where the reform movement seems to recognize that it needs to find common ground with a more popular base of support. And we see from the progressive movement the desire to, I think, find common cause with working class and workers' rights movements. So we see many of the good government groups that had supported, say, the suffrage movement for women and later the League of Women Voters, these groups then find common cause with the Socialist Party, with the Communist Party, with the American Labor Party, and also with African American rights groups. And they all see in proportional representation an opportunity to gain power in New York City politics. And you have this fascinating sort of nexus in this relatively brief moment in time where all of these diverse groups that had never before seen eye to eye on much of anything, they see PR as the common element where they can ally across their great divisions for at least a brief moment in time, see that they have some common base of support PR as a way for each of their own interests to come together to get power in New York City against the Democratic and Republican parties. And just as you say, the Democratic and Republican parties, which had never agreed on anything in their histories, are now able to bridge their gaps and come together and say, well, we will collude, and they do actually collude behind closed doors to come up with campaigns where they strategize and come up with mutually beneficial political strategies to attack PR, precisely because they don't want any third parties to rise up that would ultimately be seen as challenging their hegemony in New York City politics.
Right, right. It's a very interesting group of bedfellows that line up on both sides, and the arguments that fly back and forth are interesting as well, because none of them really jive with each other as well.
Right.
So this brings us quickly to the period at hand. After you've done talk you're done in the beginning of the book talking about the run-up to this period. We're around the time of the Seabury investigations, which are so important to Fiorella LaGuardia being elected in New York, and LaGuardia's long mayoralty, which is a key factor here. We have this broad reform coalition. So tell us what happens from here. How does PR get established in New York?
Sure. I think the Depression is absolutely essential to this. So the Great Depression happens at a moment where Tammany Hall is basically in a role of supreme authority in New York City. It seems at the end of the 1920s that nothing can stop Tammany Hall from continuing its role as the head of New York City government. The Republican Party certainly can't match the power that Tammany Hall has. Jimmy Walker seems perfectly content to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, right? And just sort of flaunts himself around the city, and the media loves him for it. Right. Yeah. So the media is not in a position where it is going to criticize Jimmy Walker. And he quite flamboyantly enjoys his position and thumbs his nose at anyone who would dare to challenge his lifestyle. Right. But the Great Depression, I think, serves as its own sort of challenge to the misrule of Tammany Hall. And I point out in a couple of sections that the Great Depression very much reveals, both at the national, the state, and especially the local level, the degree to which all of the decades of malfeasance of Tammany Hall serves to really put New Yorkers at risk, and the depth of misrule that had been performed by Tammany Hall for so many years, I think allows an opening for Seabury, for Franklin Roosevelt, versus at the state level, and then certainly at the national level, to say, this is what good government can do for you, the people of New York, right? And now Seabury, LaGuardia, and also Franklin Roosevelt in his own way, are able to endorse governmental reform in New York City to a public that is desperate for some kind of change. And I think the Depression is essential for that transition in the popular mindset about what government can mean. And PR is not the only change that they want, but PR becomes wrapped in that, I think, collection of reforms that happens in the early to mid-1930s. And Roosevelt, I don't think I found anything where Franklin Roosevelt specifically lauds PR, but he very much endorses the overall package that PR is a part of. And he's no friend of Tammany Hall, and he sees PR, and his allies certainly see PR as being part of this reform movement that can hopefully permanently remove PR, or I'm sorry, they can hopefully permanently remove Tammany Hall from the picture. If PR can come in and set up an electoral framework that prevents Tammany candidates from being elected, that's all the better for Roosevelt, for LaGuardia, and all of their political allies. And that really feeds that good government movement, that reform movement in the mid-1930s. And I think that helps explain why PR and charter reform are successful in 1936.
Yeah. I mean, in the eyes of the advocates of PR, this becomes the vehicle to having the kind of democracy Americans like think that they have, right? The parties are responsible and responsive to the public.
That's precisely right.
And we have choices.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, and the extremity of the Depression just creates situations where it's such an emergency that we actually do experiment as the founding fathers intended. So give us a little bit of the details about the specifics of how the PR system gets established. Charter reform becomes incredibly important here in the states. State conventions for establishing this system as well as dislodging it, right?
Absolutely. So you have a movement for charter reform, which seeks to do away with the old Board of Aldermen, which was seen as really a do-nothing kind of legislature that was depicted as really not doing much in the way of producing legislation that would actually help the people of New York City. So charter reform incorporates a new city government, essentially, a new framework for governing the city of New York, including the creation of a new city council that would hopefully be more proactive in terms of helping the people of New York City amid the Great Depression. And that new city council would be elected by proportional representation. So we have a new city council, a new a system by which that council will be elected, and that system is proportional representation. And that PR system would allow for the ranked choice option, right, where you have voters able to select candidates, like I said before. But most importantly, there were provisions by which any candidate could be placed on a ballot. All voters needed to do, or all candidates needed to do, was get a certain number of signatures on their petitions. If they were able to get 2,000 names on their petitions and submit those petitions to the Board of Elections, they were automatically on the ballot. So no longer did those candidates have to go through the party system at all. They didn't have to be designated official candidates to get on the ballot. And this was a radical change. This was perhaps one of the most radical changes that was brought by charter reform. You no longer had to be endorsed by a party. And this is something that's still fought over today when candidates run for office, is do you have to go through the official party apparatus, or can you run successfully as an independent? So charter reform and PR brought in the system whereby you only needed 2,000 names, 2,000 petition signatures to get on the ballot. And then to get elected, you only needed to get 75,000 votes in any particular borough. So again, you're not running against any one opponent. You're only trying to meet a minimum threshold of votes. And if you reach that minimum threshold in a particular borough, it doesn't matter what your opponent gets in terms of votes. If you get 75,000, you're automatically elected. And in some states, such as I believe Michigan and California, this provision caused PR to be ruled unconstitutional. And when the New York Court of Appeals adjudicated the issue, this was the central question as to whether PR would be ruled unconstitutional or constitutional, whether that provision that allowed for candidates to be elected by reaching a minimum threshold, whether that was essentially legal or illegal.
And how do they come to those determinations?
With regard to the minimum threshold, or with regard to whether it's constitutional?
In what sense are they determining this unconstitutional?
The idea is whether a voter has the ability to vote for all of the officials that will represent that particular voter. So in the PR system, if I were to be living in the borough of Brooklyn, Brooklyn under this PR system will have, say, 8 or 9 city council members that will represent me. I can't vote for 8 or 9 city council members, right? I only have one vote. So many state constitutions, and the Supreme Court would weigh on this later, say that if there's essentially a one person, one vote requirement according to the Constitution,
right.
And that PR violates this idea of one person, one vote, because I'm not able to vote for all 8 or 9 city council members that represent the borough of Brooklyn.
Yeah, but this is also a little bit hypocritical, right? Because there's all these other features at the time,
precisely,
in which the one vote, one person vote, is the concept is being flagrantly denied.
Precisely,
right?
Precisely.
Still today.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So, under the former Board of Aldermen system, I would have been in a district where I was represented by one Board of Aldermen member, right? But under the new city council framework, I am represented by several council members that represent the borough at large. And that's a critical change. And in other states, PR was ruled unconstitutional. In New York State, a couple of the local courts offered competing rulings. And Brooklyn, I think, ruled, I may be mixing these up, but I think Brooklyn ruled this unconstitutional, and Manhattan may have ruled it constitutional. So it went to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals concluded that it was constitutional, primarily saying that there needs to be experimentation in democracy. And it went with the idea that it's okay to experiment every once in a while in the way that PR is experimenting. And observers at the time were concerned for fear that this could go really either way. In the 1920s, some of the primary proponents for PR in New York City actually didn't want to send a test case forward because they feared that given who was on the bench at the time, they were assured that it would have been ruled unconstitutional. And they actually refused to sort of put a case forward because they were almost certain that it would have been ruled unconstitutional, I believe, in 1922.
Yeah, and judges are not nonpartisan actors.
Precisely,
here. I mean,
precisely.
Right, Judge Seabury, who is famous for these investigations into Tammany Hall, comes out very strongly for PR. Right, makes it the centerpiece of his recommendations for how to better clean up City Hall. The Tammany and the machines still have control over judicial appointments as part of their patronage powers up until the 50s.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's precisely right. And so there's a great deal of back and forth behind the scenes over where to send the cases, right, and when to send the cases, precisely with the realization that the timing is everything in terms of whether this is going to be judged favorably or not. But the Court of Appeals rules that this is constitutional and can go forward. And these rulings happen in 1936 and 37, right at the critical junctures before the charter reform referendum, and then right before the actual votes occur for the first city council election, right? So this is sort of leading right into the moments where you have PR first utilized in 1937, and there's questions still as to whether this can even happen legally.
Yeah, but and we've said that the Depression was very important. It's also that we have a sort of little galaxy of figures here who are so popular, who become standard bearers, even when they're not explicitly standard bearers for PR, right? LaGuardia and FDR. I mean, the vote for establishing PRs goes, 2-1? Even though there's tremendous, all these political actors against the system are coming out very strongly for it. Even figures who, were sort of advocates of some form of PR in the past, like Al Smith, are talking against this stuff. But the American Labor Party, which is essentially established to be the anti-Tammany party, and it is to get LaGuardia elected to vote for the New Deal, right, which Tammany comes out against. Tammany, comes out against their own former man, in a way, FDR in 36. So when this election is taking place with all this legality still up in the air, PR is seen as a vehicle still to establishing these powerful figures in their agendas, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. And you have a moment where the populace is trying to have its say too, right? So when the popular votes occur with regard to PR, the popular votes aren't close, right? The charter referendum and the votes for PR in 1936 are 2-1. Right. So it's fascinating to see how much wrangling occurs between, say, the power brokers in the city and how close those negotiations are. Right. And in terms of the Charter Reform Commission in 1935, even the votes that happen in 1938 with the state constitutional convention and how close that is. But then when the popular votes occur with the charter referendum in 1936, 1938, 1940, those are all wide margins. When the public is able to have its chance to say what it wants about PR, they're 2-1 and then more than 2-1 margins in favor of the system, which is interesting when the public finally has its say about whether it would like to have this particular approach to electing its representatives.
Right, right. and a system that they're not familiar with, but they like the idea of more choice, right?
That's
more
right. Control. That's right.
Yeah.
And that point that you raise about whether the public has any real grasp of what it's utilizing is something that is debated throughout this 10-year period. And that gets to something that I think people who advocated and argued against the system very much concerned themselves with, because it was difficult to say exactly how many people truly understood the implications of the system. Certainly people utilized the system, and vote totals for the council increased versus the total vote for the Board of Aldermen. And that could have happened for any number of reasons. But the advocates for PR used it as justification for their side, saying that this shows that people are more engaged with the city council or more engaged with the process of democracy under this new system. At the same time, I think, as you alluded to earlier, voting under PR was a bit of a wreck in many circumstances. There were ways in which simply having to have so many hundreds of thousands of paper ballots, one was over 4 feet long in the case of the borough of Brooklyn in 1937, because it had 99 different candidates. That borough's vote alone took about a month to count because of all of the different transfers that had to happen. I think there were about 30 different transfers that needed to happen. That this is before calculators. It's obviously before computers. Everything needed to be done by hand. Everything needed to be rechecked again and again and again to certify the votes. And those delays were used as fodder by critics of the system to say that our democracy needs to be run more efficiently. Ironic rhetoric, given that these were the very same critics who had run the ultimately quite corrupt version of democracy that they had operated for so many generations prior.
Right. There's some language here I want to quote from your book. This comes from a section of the new city charter, right? Explaining a little bit how this system will work. And it says, if during the first sorting a ballot is found which is marked first choice for a candidate already elected, but shows no choice for an unelected candidate, it shall be given to the candidate of its first choice and its place the last previous ballot, if any, sorted to that candidate which does show a choice for an unelected candidate, shall be taken and resorted to its next available choice as if it were then being sorted for the first time. I mean, I read that several times and tried to follow it, and it was dizzy.
Right.
And, you know, you make the comment early on that the system was so complicated, as you rightly know, this is the age before computers and all these things, calculators. It depended upon the country's number one advocate, a guy named George Hallett, right, who was a mathematician.
That's absolutely right. George Hallett has a PhD in mathematics from the University of Pennsylvania. He advocates the system. It seems like that's all he does. I've read many of his papers, and he advocates it for decades. He's quite an impressive figure for how much he appreciates PR, and he views the system as ultimately the most efficient way of guiding our democracy, which is fascinating given how inefficient and messy the system was as practiced in New York City. And he recognized that. I mean, he wrote many times in a variety of journals about how to reform his own vision of PR, because he was the person who was, monitoring the counts in many of the boroughs. I mean, he was on the ground day after day looking over everyone's shoulder. He was looking over the canvassers' shoulders to make sure that they were operating the system correctly. And he most likely wrote that paragraph that you just read. He was the person who wrote the minutiae of the regulations in New York City. And I've tried to locate more specific details about the instructions that the canvassers were given. And the best I've been able to come up with is that there's actually some pretty open allowances for randomness in in those guidelines, which suggests that depending upon which election district you were in, there would be variation ultimately in the totals, because just what you read doesn't provide, this gets into the weeds of it, but I mean, depending upon which election district you were in, if your ballot was counted first or last would produce some variation, right? Mm-hmm. And there are some specific statistical reasons for why that was, but it all had to do with whether your, if you had a one and your first choice was counted, or if you had a one and you had many other second, third, or fourth choices, if the canvasser decided to count your one and you had second, third, or fourth choices or didn't, it could impact some of the other second, third, or fourth choices, right, depending yeah. upon how your vote was distributed or whether it was distributed.
And how much of this is a special case for New York? I mean, do you have how much sense do you have about the way the system is practiced in Europe and in other parts of the country, and how much this is sort of is this design, this complicated nature? Is this sort of a sandbag type situation like we often have with the legislation?
Sure, sure. I did some of my research at the a similar organization's archives in London. At the Electoral Reform Society in London, and these two groups, the Proportional Representation League and the Proportional Representation Society, what became the Electoral Reform Society in London, had frequent correspondence over the decades across the Atlantic, sort of participating in one another's campaigns, trading strategies back and forth over the decades, really produced some fascinating correspondence as they were trying to encourage one another to do the best that they could to help ensure that PR would spread both in Europe and in the United States. And I was talking with some of the people that worked at the Electoral Reform Society in London, and one of whom had just come back from Ohio because he was helping to advise a campaign in Ohio. This would have been around 2004 to help encourage STV, an STV campaign in Ohio. And I talked about how much difficulty I was having in trying to find the guidelines for what was going on in New York City. And he was utterly dismayed by the kind of randomness that I was locating in how PR was practiced in New York City. And suggested that that was really unusual, that there weren't more specifics. As they say, the absence of evidence isn't necessarily evidence in and of itself, but the sense that I have is that given the overwhelming number of ballots that needed to be counted and the speed at which the system moved through, that there is a sense that there were some gaps in the process. And I think Hallett was, from the correspondence I've read from him, Hallett was trying to deal with this on the fly. It's something that he recognized was a problem, and he was trying to change it.
Well, so this is a turning point in New York City history. And tell us about some of the changes that are wrought as a result of these elections. I mean, you alluded to it earlier, but I mean, this is the period when Adam Clayton Powell comes to power, Genevieve Earle. Tell us about some of these folks and what these changes meant politically for the city.
Certainly. I think it's, you know, as we talked about before, it's a fascinating moment where you have, I think that with regard to gender and race in particular, you have a new vision of who is able to serve in high office in New York City government. And I don't think that can be underemphasized, to have folks like Adam Clayton Powell. Very soon thereafter, Ben Davis comes in and essentially takes over Adam Clayton Powell's seat. Ben Davis is essentially endorsed by Adam Clayton Powell. Ben Davis comes in, who is an avowed communist, and is elected to basically replace Adam Clayton Powell. And Adam Clayton Powell and Ben Davis utilize their seats on the city council to advocate for reforms that had never been advocated in City Hall. They're talking about issues like police brutality. They're talking about civil rights. They're talking about integration and public housing. They're talking about a variety of reforms in ways that I think challenge very old practices in New York City. And I think people of African descent in New York City had never really had that kind of official platform in city government from which to offer these proposals. That's not to say that the proposals were successful, because for the most part they weren't at all. But I think PR provides a mechanism by which these proposals can be advocated from positions of relative power and a position, at least at the seat of government, where previously that had been absent. And I think that's very interesting to consider.
Yeah, well, especially since, I mean, Powell himself, you know, famous for the Powell Amendment. I mean, a guy who, you know, had a flamboyant career and was often absent from Congress, but, you know, became famous for stamping and sandbagging every piece of legislation that came across his aisle that threatened to discriminate against African Americans by putting in an anti-discrimination rider, right? A tactic that, you know, conservatives used to use to get the Southern Democratic vote, too.
That's right.
And as historians of the civil rights movement appreciate how much New York in particular is important to the long arc of the movement. I mean, these are significant facts.
That's right. And then, so you have, you know, some of the arguments with regard to Stuyvesant Town and the proposed integration of Stuyvesant Town, just as you say, very much then I think have far-reaching and national implications that connect with the so-called early civil rights movement and have been used by other historians to, I think, begin to build that bridge to what happened, say, nationally in the 1950s with regard to the emergence of that sort of national discourse about civil rights. You mentioned Genevieve Earle. Genevieve Earle is the second woman to be elected to the New York City legislature. She becomes the minority leader of the city council and is elected all five times that PR is utilized to elect city council members. And she is minority leader for the majority of the time that we have PR. She advocates a variety of programs that really have their heritage in the progressive movement. I mean, she's talking about sanitation. She's talking about food and safety standards. She's talking about protections for women. She had sort of come up with the League of Women Voters. So I think her advocacy is very much situated in that era of progressive era reform. But nonetheless, she sees some common ground with far more radical members of the city council. And she's able to ally herself at times with the Communist Party members around some of these issues, along with Stanley Isaacs with regard to integration of Stuyvesant Town. So that alliance in the minority is able to, if unsuccessfully, nonetheless use their status as PR elected members to advocate for programs that really would not have ever seen the light of day in an official setting at this particular time in New York City.
Yeah. Well, it's also important to note here that, you know, New York City was exceptional for the high number of communists that it had. I mean, the party never has more than 100,000 people in it, but it jumps from 50 to 100,000 during the late 30s. They're in this popular front era when all of a sudden, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln are showing up on Communist Party placards, and they're saying that communism is 20th century Americanism. And they're really sort of seeking to use their considerable organizational power to advocate for general progressive legislation.
That's absolutely right. And we see sort of the continuation of the popular front strategy of activism, where the Communist Party in the midst of World War II is trying to appeal broadly using some of the icons that you just described. And I think we see that in the election results. We see election results in which there are far more votes for the communist legislators than there are registered communists in New York City, by far. The communists receive some of the highest vote totals in the PR elections among any candidates. Ben Davis, in particular, receives consistently some of the highest totals amongst all of the candidates. And I think it's with Davis and Peter Caccione, another communist representative, it's with their elections to the council that we see a very important turn against the system, where anti-communism is then used as sort of the bludgeoning device that very quickly and very powerfully turns the rhetorical debate against PR into something where PR is a stand-in for the Soviet Union, for radicalism, at times for fascism and Hitlerism from the early 1940s through the early Cold War. And I think opponents of PR are able to sort of center their attention on PR and the communist representatives that are elected by the system in such a consistent way that that really sort of colors the popular understanding of PR for most of the early 1940s.
Yeah, I mean, New York City is exceptional too because it has all those refugees from communist Russia. It has refugees from fascist Europe. So some of these rhetorical baits about PR being a vehicle to totalitarianism are powerful, right? Because there's a sort of sense of fear of democracy at work here in some of this language, right?
That's absolutely right. And some of the images that I found that I wasn't able to put in the book are produced in the languages of a variety of the populations that you just described, coming from throughout Europe. So those pamphlets, some of which are included but in English in the book, are incorporated in a variety of various European languages, specifically to appeal to those immigrant groups coming over during the course of World War II, to play upon their memories of the strife in Europe. And to connect those memories and their visceral concerns about what's happened in Europe and their anxieties about what the transition process is going to be like in New York City to how they should think about proportional representation and how they should vote with regard to the future of proportional representation. And the allies of proportional representation do the very same thing and suggest that they need to see, these immigrants should see proportional representation as a way for them to protect their own interests now that they've arrived in New York City. And allies of PR present the system as a way for these new Americans to establish themselves. And to gain representation, whereas otherwise they won't be able to. So again, the starkness of the differences in how the system is presented continues on through the end of the war.
Yeah, and there's this as ever a state in America. There's this state urban conflict, right? Because the state is essentially denying the city constantly home rule in a variety of ways, and PR becomes a model that other cities in New York start contemplating adopting, right? And so the state legislature is freaking out because this alters the balance of power, right? I mean, where the legislature was able to bilk the city essentially for all of the economic wealth that it produced from its sort of unaccountable place in Albany. And PR just sort of upsets this two-party monopoly that we have.
That's absolutely right. And the proponents of PR in New York City, like George Hallett, they go to the state government, they go to Albany, and they propose expanding PR to the state legislature, which, as you would imagine, is the last thing that Albany would want to do. Albany is still very much controlled by upstate Republicans for the most part, given the lack of proportional representation that is used to elect the state legislature, and that sort of upstate alliance desires to quash any attempt at expanding PR statewide, and they successfully prevent that. And there are other smaller communities like New Rochelle and others that try to get PR referendum on their ballots, but those are prevented as well for precisely the same reason.
Yeah, up until the Warren Court, right? We don't have laws that are striking down this rurally tilted system that dramatically overinflates small towns and suburban areas to give Republicans control of the Northeast, where you would think that they would dominate all the legislatures, right?
Exactly, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Why don't you talk a little bit about this, the Little Red Scare, and bring us towards the end of this system? Talk about how the Republicans turn against PR and how all this ends up.
Sure. So the Republican Party, ironically enough, gains representation under PR. The Republicans win proportionally more seats in the city council through PR than they had under the old electoral system, the district-based electoral system for the Board of Aldermen. But the Republican Party moves fairly quickly against PR because it seems to be that they're more concerned about the rising tide of third parties that are elected under the system. So the Republican Party seems to be concerned about having socialists, American Labor Party members, Liberal Party members, communists elected, and allies itself with the Democratic Party precisely because it wants to essentially be a second party without any third party option. So the Republican Party and the Democratic Party ally against all of the other options, and focuses in the midst of the election of the two communists, Caccione and Davis, to red bait the system, which they do consistently after the election of Peter Caccione first in 1941, and then the election of Caccione and Davis in both 1943 and 1945. So during World War II, you have multiple elections in New York City in which communists are elected. And these communists aren't elected undercover. They run as Communist Party members. And I think this is just fascinating for how we understand both the World War II era and how we understand democracy. Moreover, after World War II is over in November 1945, during what people usually describe as the early Cold War, the communists win again. We have Davis and Caccione winning again in November 1945. And it's this would have otherwise been a moment for the repeal movement to strike. But the leaders of the repeal movement, including Parks Commissioner Robert Moses, feared that the war and the basically the rising tide of patriotism that occurred in the immediate aftermath of the victory in the war would have not been the right time to attack PR. They were concerned that doing anything when Roosevelt had been alive during the war, when LaGuardia was still popular during the war, would have simply brought another defeat. PR referenda were victorious in 1938 and 1940. So the critics of PR decided to wait, and they decided to wait all the way until 1947. During a congressional off year, so that they could wait until after the war by a couple of years, so that they could wait until LaGuardia was basically out of the picture, so that they could wait until after President Roosevelt's death. And this was all timed to coincide with what they viewed to be the smallest possible voter turnout and voter interest in the election. Right. And that's when the next repeal effort happened. And the repeal was then timed to coincide, was timed to coincide with the wave of anti-communist sentiment that was occurring in 1947, when you have the Truman Doctrine amongst the wave of anti-communist propaganda that is spreading nationwide. And it's in that context that you have the defeat of proportional representation in New York City by a 2-to-1 margin in a nearly reverse of the vote totals that you had back in 1936.
Right.
And that is the end of proportional representation. In the next city council elections that you have a few years later, you have the removal of all but one of the PR allies from the previous council. So you go from having a relatively balanced council under PR to almost an exclusively Democratic council without PR. Despite the fact that the Democratic Party is still only able to muster a little over half of the vote. So the actual vote totals for the Democratic Party remain about the same. The Democratic Party gets a little over 50% of the vote, but the Democratic Party is able to hold, I believe, around 90% of the seats. But in terms of district-based allocation of representation, the Democratic Party holds nearly all of the seats in the city council.
Yeah, I mean, much of the story reads like this struggle between politicians who are conspiratorially denying Americans the vote and actors who are constantly sort of shifting positions a little bit on PR, depending upon what the sort of short-term result has been, right?
Right.
So one-time friends become enemies because they don't like the way the last election went.
Right.
There's a sort of faithlessness with allowing democracy to sort of flower and go the wrong, go, you know, don't go, to not go the way we want to sometimes.
Sure, sure. And at the party level, you have the Democratic Party, which gets what it wants. It's able to maintain power for decades as the sort of primary hegemon in New York City. The Republican Party, I guess, gets what it wants, right? It is the second party, although it has very little representation in the city council. And then we think about some of the individuals. Robert Moses, who is parks commissioner, he had many of his proposals opposed quite vociferously by those PR allies at the city council level. So, you know, Stuyvesant Town was one of his babies. It was one of his star proposals, right? And star plans. He had been picked at by folks like Ben Davis and Stanley Isaacs and Adam Clayton Powell. And now he has been able to remove the system that facilitated his opponent's election. And after they're removed and that system's removed, he has almost free rein over the development projects that he has long sought. And he will continue in his sort of mini kingdom for decades.
Right. I mean, he has, what, 12 positions at one
exactly,
point?
Exactly.
Public and private boroughs. He's independent financing. He's unaccountable to any administration.
That's absolutely right. Genevieve Earle resigns after PR is removed because she understands that she basically has no future in the new electoral system. And we don't see the election of a new female candidate to the city council until the mid-1960s. It's not until 1965 that we get a new woman elected to the city council. So it's again a fascinating transition in so many different ways from the kind of diversity and representation and policymaking that we had in the PR era of the 1930s and 40s to what comes in its aftermath.
So is this the sort of emasculation of the city council? The city council returns to sort of being a, you know, you make the point that with PR for the first time there's debate on city councils, right? WNYC is carrying live these broadcasts of debate, which supremely upsets all the senior members because they're used to having this place be a rubber stamp body, right?
That's right. That's right. And it certainly seems that we then transition into the more staid era of the late 40s and then in the 50s before we have, I think, the return to more activist agendas, frankly, in the 1960s, which are then associated with many of the movements that folks are probably more familiar with, right? Where challenges return to I think that order offered by the Democratic and Republican parties, right? But it takes that kind of challenge that comes in the late 50s and early 60s before that happens.
So your book is about New York. What's the fate of this for? I mean, you made the allusion earlier on that this is not a system that is just some sort of quaint anachronism. It's still practiced in many parts of the world. What's the fate for this system in other parts of the country and today and in Europe and other places?
This system, not necessarily the single transferable vote, but variations of proportional representation are really the most popular model of democracy in parliamentary governments throughout the world. The sense that representation should be provided proportionally to how people vote really is the guiding framework for democratic governments.
Right.
And the United States is kind of the outlier in its vision of democracy, if you will. And certainly we could have a whole different conversation about why the United States is the outlier in that regard with its history of the two-party framework. But I think what I found interesting about how PR and the single transferable vote has existed in its own limited way in the United States was the way in which there have been communities that have attempted to incorporate this system at the local level, and a few continue. Like Cambridge, Massachusetts, is perhaps the most famous example of a city that has, I think, for a very long time incorporated the single transferable vote. New York City School Board elections have utilized the single transferable vote. At the state level and at the local level, there are a variety of smaller offices, more minor offices, that continue to use the single transferable vote. Usually you will find these in offices where voters are asked to vote for a variety of different positions at once, usually for, say, judgeships, right? For here in North Carolina, where we have multiple judges that are elected at the same time, STV will be used. I think the most famous example of this that you might not know of is that this is how the Academy Awards select the best picture currently, where the Academy voters have a pool of best picture nominees, and then STV is essentially used, or a modified version of it is used. And it's from that larger pool that the primary best film is now selected. And this was a change that was made a few years ago now. But I think that there are more and more communities that are trying to incorporate STV. I think a version that is become increasingly popular in places like the Bay Area of California is called instant runoff voting. Right, which allows for the possibility of having, say, a third candidate, if not a greater variety of candidates, but at least a third candidate to provide for more diversity in the election process. So I think that's what people have been struggling to bring into at least the United States version of democracy.
Yeah. Well, I'm amused. I was amused by all these quotes in here from opponents of PR who tried to convert the two-party system, which was not intended at all by the founders. I mean, you read the Federalist Papers, and it's predicting that there's not going to be any parties in America. And then it's 10 days after George Washington's election that the Democratic Party gets started. But you have these people who try to equate the two-party system, this monopoly, this very undemocratic thing, into a form of patriotism, right? I believe in the two-party system, as if this was some sort of like Americanism that was intended and is democratic. And what I think is interesting about the book, and I try to, I do this in my own work too. You make the point in the introduction that we typically, historiographically, think about the rise of American democracy, and that means typically the expansion of the franchise, when it's really how democracy is structured that's just as important as who gets the right to vote, right? So America is this outlier in that we have these systems that are not followed by most of the democracies in the world, and PR and these other things sort of feed into that. So it's a really interesting topic.
Mm-hmm. And just one last thing, which is that when the United States in its role in international affairs has served to try to structure and restructure democratic systems, what it views as democratic systems throughout the world, it is incorporated proportional representation in those systems, right? And this is one of the points I make in the introduction, right? So then in its occupation of Iraq, in the restructuring of governments after World War II, it is incorporated proportional representation systems, precisely because it viewed proportionality and representation as something useful, at least in terms of its foreign policy agenda in those various situations, right? And it viewed proportionality and representation as fundamental to the project of democracy, right? And that was that was something that was absolutely essential to the goals of those various occupations, which is different than how the project of democracy is so often understood within the borders of the United States.
Right, right. Well, it's a great book. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us today. Maybe you could take us out by talking about what you're working on now.
Absolutely. My current project is situated in the same chronological time period, but I've tried to move very far away from electoral politics, and I'm looking at the history of atomic science and nuclear technology during the early decades of the 20th century. The tentative title is Atomic Dreams, Creating a Nuclear World in the Decades Before the Cold War, and I'm trying to find the intersections of art, science, culture, and commerce in the fashioning of an atomic world in the run-up to nuclear technology during the Cold War. And I'm very curious to see how this develops.
So am I. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, and it's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye, Dan.